Hi, it's Tim Dre, president of the Illinois AFL-CIO. Thank you for listening to The Worker's Mic, supported by the Illinois AFL-CIO, fighting every day for working families. Visit ilafl-cio.org today. Enjoy the show, and remember, it's better in a union.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Worker's Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor, right here on 720 WGN. I'm Ed Maher with the National Coalition of Labor. Here with me today is Phil Davidson from the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ed.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year as well.
And we have a special guest in the studio. You may have heard throughout the week he's been promoted across WGN, and that is labor legend and general counsel of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, Dale Pearson.
Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Of course. Good
Happy
to have you.
Great.
It's not often we get a legend in the studio.
That's exactly right.
You guys are too kind.
Well, it's great to have you back. You've been in before. You've always been a massive friend of the show, so we're happy to have you in today. How were your holidays, Phil? What'd you do? You know, I haven't seen you in a little while.
Yeah, it's been a
bit. How's your New Year's?
New Year's was good. Family's finally healthy again, so that was good. It was infirmary in my house for, I don't know, the past 12 days.
I know it was even longer. They say. It'll be great, they
I know,
say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Just make sure you walk around in a hazmat suit and a mask at all times, and yeah, then you can enjoy their company and their presence.
Yeah, you dropped off your kids at school sometime in November, I'm guessing, right. And you saw some kids sniffle up a bunch of mucus, and you knew this was coming.
Nothing raises my ire more than seeing that kid sniffling and coughing
everywhere.
Because you
know what's coming.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
Glad you guys are all doing better.
Brace yourself. Yeah, how about you? How's your health?
I'm better. I spent the whole month of December, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Just cold, RSV, whatever. Anything you can get from kids, I got it all. But I'm, you know, back to my fighting strength.
Good.
Feeling good, yeah.
You're looking good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually true. I checked that out this morning, and you are correct. Dale, how about you? How were your holidays?
Holidays were really good, Ed. We carried on my wife's family tradition of making homemade ravioli, the Italian grandmother's recipe.
Nice.
Had a fabulous meal, and then the family, she's the oldest of 13, so she's got a big family. We always finish off Christmas with a game of left, right, center.
Yeah, for sure.
Of course.
And it's just absolutely nuts.
High stakes.
If you get a big crowd in there.
17 people around tables pushed together. We play for, you know, a dollar, so it's like the $3 that you're moving around, and you'd think you're playing for thousands.
But yeah, that's a fun game.
That's one of my favorite parts of the holidays is if you get into card games with family, because it starts off sort of friendly, and the closer you get to the end, people just get riled up, and it gets hostile.
You get to learn a lot about people.
Yeah, you learn swears from your grandparents that you never even heard before.
A lot of posturing.
Our last round, I ended up not having any dollar bills in front of me. Then all of a sudden at the end, I picked up one more dollar bill. So it was me and my niece across the table.
Yeah.
And I'd been rolling several times, and I was like fooling around, right? So I'm covering my eyes. I'm like, I'll roll blind and watch this. And it's a dot.
Gloating.
And right. So I do that three times. And then she starts to mock me. She's like, so she's rolling blind. And then she wins.
That sounds pretty, like a pretty typical experience with that.
Yeah. I kind of want to try this ravioli recipe.
I was going to say, I think I must have missed the call for the invitation.
Is it under lock and key, the recipe? Some people are very protective of their sauce recipes.
It's all in their heads.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, secret ingredient is Velveeta. So we've been talking about having Dale in for a few weeks now to talk about the origins of the word scab. It was a question we had months ago. Where did the word scab come from? And of course, who better to consult on this than labor historian and knower of many, many things, Dale Pearson. So we're going to get to that in the next segment. But there have been a couple of sort of big developments over the past week or so that we want to cover first. And one of them that I think is topical with Christmas holiday break was I saw a bunch of videos on TikTok, which I've now given up. People lined up on ski hills in Park City, Utah. And there were half-mile-long lines to get on the gondolas to get up the hill. And it was all over a strike by ski patrol workers and employees of Vail Resorts at this Park City resort. They went on strike and basically just shut down these mountains during the busiest time of year.
No fury, like a skier scorn, a rich family for skiing out west at a, you know, $1,000 a night resort for sure.
The really rich ones out there, like Rock Hardwell and his wife Buffy, I don't feel bad for them. They probably rented a helicopter, but, you know, it was all over the ski patrol folks wanted, their starting pay started, I think, at $21 an hour, and they were trying to get it up to $23, and that's what this was over.
Yeah.
So the people in these obnoxiously long lines were chanting slogans that were, you know, with the workers. They were like, Vail, treat your workers right, and things like that. So
over $2.
I know.
Yes.
I know. So they got a deal. They're back to work, and got done so quickly. I think they probably should have asked for more.
Yeah, good for them. They deserve. I mean, they're only the people protecting the skiers on the mountain. It's like,
I've been to like Wilmot and seen 10 people carted off the mountain.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, a lot of tragic deaths, celebrity deaths. Yeah.
When I was younger and more elastic, let's say, I used to take some nasty falls skiing, and I never got hurt. I think if I did it now, I'd be in trouble. I'd be one of those getting hauled off the mountain. So true. Take care of your ski patrollers.
I hope they, if they didn't, they missed an opportunity. You've seen the movie Better Off Dead, the 80s movie with John Cusack?
I haven't. I'm not a big John Cusack fan.
This was in his heyday, his 80s heyday, but there's a movie that's based at a ski resort, and this kid who's a neighborhood paper boy comes to the family and says, you owe me $2, and that becomes like a recurring theme of the movie, and he shows up in scenes, $2, $2. So that would have been a great campaign for the ski patrollers there. He's going, $2.
Thank you very much for that, Phil.
You're welcome.
That was very interesting.
You got to see it. The Better Off Dead fans out there know what I'm talking about. They're
laughing. Speaking of taking care of people, we always talk on the show. Every couple weeks we check in with the situation with the Chicago Fire Department and the Chicago Firefighters Local 2. They have been without a contract, I think, for 1,300 days.
Is that what it's up to
1,300 days, something like that now. Uh-huh. And the city refuses to budget to fully staff the trucks. We don't have ambulances in many wards of the city. And in the midst of all this sort of tragic fire that's burnt down, I don't know how many homes at this point, but
10,000 structures.
An incredible amount of homes.
Thousands, yes.
In Los Angeles, I keep reading that the fire department has just been underfunded, and the funding's been cut and cut and cut. So those folks, when you need them, you need them.
Right.
So listen up, Mayor Brandon Johnson and City of Chicago. If you've got a couple extra nickels rolling around the City Hall, take care of the firefighters. It's the right thing to do. Everybody else is counting on them, and you should be also. But of course, you know, we're all watching, and thoughts go out to everybody in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's so tragic,
struggling
and
with that.
All the firefighters out there, everyone, first responders.
Yeah. Well, they put the face on it as though it's celebrities. All these millionaires losing their mansions. But it's not.
No.
You look at the neighborhoods that have burnt down, and it's ordinary folks who are not going to recover from this very quickly.
Yeah, Friday's New York Times front page story about how it's cut across socioeconomic groups and neighborhoods. It's hit everybody.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of those people are uninsured because a lot of the carriers all pulled out of there. Like,
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I don't think State Farm are insuring homes there anymore. And so, yeah, a lot of people might have lost everything, and they don't have any recourse or, you know, any way to rebuild their lives. So it's tragic.
That's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. Reading more articles about this all the time, and I've got cousins that live in Evergreen, Colorado, which is like a Denver suburb.
Uh-huh.
And they're one of those zip codes that have been, now we're not going to renew your insurance.
Right.
Wow.
Fire insurance in California, flood insurance in Florida, all over the place. You buy a house and you just can't insure it.
Yeah.
Some places require you to carry insurance, or mortgages will require you to carry insurance.
Yeah, you have to carry mortgage. Right, I know. And a lot of them have to go to the state fund because the state will provide very minimal coverage, but those are obviously getting tapped now, and it's a mess.
Well, as we know, people have become quite frustrated with the insurance systems, in recent months. But and then finally, we've got to take a break in a minute, but the AFL-CIO had some big news late this week with SEIU coming back into the Federation. They had broken away back in 2005, 2006, along with the Teamsters and a couple of other unions to form Change to Win, but they are now back in the AFL-CIO. 2 million members brings the AFL-CIO up to 15 million?
I think I saw 15 million
15
members.
15 million members, and the press release, the leader, Liz Schuler from the AFL-CIO. And the
guest
SEIU
on the show.
Yeah, that's right. She was a guest on the show. You got her.
Yeah, right.
And you will never let us forget
never.
That. It was a hell of a get. The leadership of SEIU were just saying this is all about organizing.
Yeah, April Verrett is her name, the president. Yeah.
We have to protect workers' rights to organize. Workers want unions, and workers are not able to get them. And I think it's safe to say it's only going to get harder in the next couple of years.
It's a big development in our world.
Huge news.
Yeah.
Huge news. But we have got to take a break, but we're going to be back. And in addition to teaching us the history of the word scab, which I guarantee you, you do not want to miss, Dale's going to talk with us about the history of Scabby the Rat, which is, for those of you out there that are not familiar, the big inflatable rats you see on job sites when there's a strike, or if you've seen them, maybe you didn't know what that thing was, but you're going to find out today. So stick around, and we'll be back.
This is going to be good. I can't wait.
More Workers' Mic right here in a few minutes on 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN. Ed Maher here with Phil Davidson, and we've got Local 150 General Counsel Dale Pearson in the studio today. Dale, we asked you a couple months ago about some of the history behind the word scab. Sometimes you'll hear in union parlance, that guy's a scab, or we have a bunch of scabs in there working. And Ken and I debated over what it means, and my thought on it was, a scab stops the bleeding. So if it's economic war against the company and they're struggling, a scab, that was my thought on it. But I don't think that that was right. And me and Ken couldn't come up with it. So we consulted you, and you have done a lot of research on this.
Yes, I have. Like all good researchers, I started with Google.
Yes.
Believe it or not, I think you are right about the notion that you're stopping the bleeding, that scabs would help struck companies stop the financial bleeding. But it's intuitive what the definition is. You know, you go to Google and you come up with the word scab as the Oxford English Dictionary in 1250 said. Wow. It was references to skin diseases. But then later on, 1400, you get a modern definition that it's a crust that forms over a cut or a sore. They say that by the 1590s, scab became a slag insult related to disreputable people whose lifestyle might result in sores or scabs.
Interesting.
Due to a disease like syphilis.
The Middle Ages must have been a lot of fun.
They were a wild
priceless
times.
Trash talk.
But I think that by the 1700s, you began to see this shift to where people would use the phrase scab or rat to disparage those who would dishonor a strike, either cross a picket line, not join a union, or engage in strike breaking.
In the 1700s?
Yes.
Was the first instance, okay.
Yes. The most colorful description, of course, is the Jack London ode to a scab.
Yeah, of his famed American author.
Right. After God finished the rattlesnake, the toad, and the vampire, he had an awful substance left with which he made a scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a waterlogged brain, and a backbone made of jelly and glue. Where others have hearts, he carries a tumor of rotten principles.
So Jack London was kind of like Eminem in his peak. You don't mention him. You don't mess with him.
No.
You don't want that. You don't want that tag bag.
Those are some bars right there. Yeah.
Yeah, he was good. So as I got into some of my favorite books, though, and this is one I'm going to lend you, Ed. It's called Calf's Head and Union Tail. Labor Yarns at Work and Play. It's a professor who's assembled a lot of old stories about strikes, union tales, and as you often see, they'll repeat over the years. Like they'll pop up here, and then it'll show up again in some union newspaper like 10 years later. So one of the really fun stories is the one called Mike Casey and the Strike Breakers. This is about a 1901 Teamster strike on the waterfront. He says, back then, San Francisco was a wide-open town with a thriving red-light district. The strike breakers began to spend evenings in a few tenderloin sporting houses. Mr. Casey and the Teamsters, knowing some of the madams, made a little arrangement. Whenever several strike breakers visited a house, the madam sent a quiet message to Casey. He dispatched four or five loyal Teamsters to each house. You might say that the Teamsters caught the toughs with their pants down.
Okay.
You might say they were sporty.
That's outside the box thinking.
Yes.
The Teamsters hustled the strike breakers to a kind of bullpen back of the Union Hall to let them cool down. They'd ask them, are you from St. Louis? Are you from Chicago? Are you from New York? They'd answer. He'd say, okay, look, we just want you to leave. Don't come back here. No questions asked. We'll send you home. Fine. Casey had another arrangement, however, with a yard crew of the Southern Pacific train men. The Teamsters hauled each night's load of strike breakers down to the Bayview rail yard and loaded the catch into a conveniently empty car, box car. 2 days later, the strikebreakers woke up to find their boxcar door open. With relief, they stepped out into the bright morning sunshine of the Imperial Valley in southern central California. By coincidence, at that time of the year, the valley growers were short-handed. They put the stranded men to work in the fields at $1 a day, sunrise to sunset. It was the first honest labor for these strikebreakers, and not a red light parlor in sight.
You know, sometimes you got to teach people the hard way.
Yeah.
So, you know, flash forward about 10 years, and now we're in New York City, where the immigration is exploding, the population, and more Jewish people are emigrating to New York and engaging in the needle trades and the textile trades.
Yeah.
The great Triangle Shirtwaist Fire is a huge spur to organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And while there were well-developed gangsters of all ethnicities in New York back at that time, what began to develop was people started to make common cause with the strikers and began to support the strikers. So when strikebreakers would engage in scab activity, the New York workers, many of whom were Jewish, would beat them up. So I'm sorry that Ken's not here, because I was going to ask him if he could give me a proper pronunciation for the term Starkers.
Despite what Ken would have you believe, I'm pretty sure he doesn't speak Yiddish. But Starker, that's a pretty good, that's a fun word.
Yeah, it's what, so these, the Starkers would beat up the scab strikebreakers. Which then leads to back to the union tale and one more little story that I think you'll enjoy. Now we're in the era of the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado, the 1913-1914,
yep,
with a lot of Greek immigrants,
yep,
who were miners at the time. So as this story goes, the Greeks, immigrant miners, had other allies, some as unlikely as the girls in the Walsenburg brothels who would tip them off when a bunch of scabs were enjoying themselves in the rooms. Then the Greeks would go down and clean the scabs out, and there would be torn knuckles, bloody heads, and a few arrests. This was the way the working girl showed her solidarity with the working man.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting story. That's something that I never knew before. You know, if you're a listener to this show, you know that we've covered out west when there were exotic dancers who were unionizing, and we were fully in support of that. We've talked about some of the horrible kind of social ills that befall sex workers that exist in every country in the world when they're not protected. And here you have multiple pieces of historical evidence that these people
were pro-union.
Yeah, they're helping workers. They're, you know, fighting for the working people and trying to raise the floor for workers. So I take my hat off to them. Only my hat.
Yes.
I take my hat off to them.
Solidarity.
Yeah, it's a cool story, and it's the people out there listening who may not be super familiar with this. It's like, what's so bad about a strikebreaker? Like, why are people so harsh toward scabs? And if you have a company where people are being mistreated, being underpaid, being abused, having their rights violated, whatever, so badly that they're willing to stop being paid and hit the streets. And then you have other folks who are just like, whatever, company, I'll take a couple bucks less. I'll help you get past this. I'll help you out. I mean, it's a dishonorable thing, and you're hurting a large group of people who all have like a common, you know, just kind of a common gripe against the company. So it's a betrayal of, in old terms, I think you'd just say it's a betrayal of the working class. If you're a worker and you're in that class, you're betraying your own people.
Yeah.
Well, and the economic model you talk about is the race to the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, if I can't find somebody who will work 10 hours for a buck, I'll find somebody who worked 10 hours for 90 cents.
Mm.
And then the workers themselves say, well, hey, I'll do it for 80 cents, or I'll work 11 hours.
Yeah.
It just continues to erode conditions for everybody, not just for those people who are fighting with each
other. People take that seriously. I know even today, firefighters from the 1980 strike in Chicago, they won't talk to scabs that came on.
You don't forget.
No, you don't forget that at all.
It only takes once in your life, and you're always
right.
A scab.
Yeah, I've witnessed it. People turn their backs on guys, you know, at T-ball games. Oh, that guy's a scab. Yeah,
they call it the Brotherhood of the Barrel.
Yep.
From 1980, I was going to law school at Northwestern at that time, and there's a firehouse on Chicago Avenue, and I would walk by and say, you know, how's it going, guys? Keep the faith, that kind of stuff. And they're very serious about it. Sweeney, our boss, had a short stint as a firefighter in Chicago.
I remember that,
And he said that it's persisted for decades. The strikers sat at these tables for lunch. The scabs sat at those tables for lunch. And very, very little rapprochement with the over that.
Yeah, I would imagine you could cut the tension in those lunchrooms. Well, thank you for the history on that, Dale.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Yeah, we've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back with some more history. It's kind of fun history about those big inflatable rats you see at job sites. You may not know the rat has a name, and his name is Scabby. And probably very few people in the world know as much about the history of this, and it all is based here in Chicago. I guarantee you'll be fascinated with this story. So stick around. We'll be right back with more Workers' Mike on 720 WGN.
You're listening to the Workers' Mike, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back to the Workers' Mic, everybody, right here on 720 WGN. Ed Maher here with Phil Davidson and Dale Pearson, for the General Counsel for the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, is joining us for another segment. And, you know, I was on, we did this segment called Worker Wednesday with John Hansen, a great friend of the show, super guy. And he made a comment toward the end of our interview on Tuesday, actually, it was this week, that he had some questions about the inflatable rat.
Yes.
So I was like, you know, Dale's coming in this weekend. We got to talk about this. So, Dale, you have been around since the earliest days of the inflatable rat that we belovedly know as Scabby. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where did Scabby come from?
Yes, indeed, Ed and Phil. It's a great story. I'll remind everybody that we just defined earlier in the show the term scab.
Yes, we did.
Rat has often been considered synonymous with the term scab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask, is there any difference between the two? Or
well, rat, I think historically, again, when you do the Google type research.
Yes, gurgle also.
It's the person who
the gurgle search.
Is an informant or traitor. Now, organized labor adopts this phrase or this term, again, to be synonymous of scabs, people who will cross picket lines, who will break strikes, who will not join the union, even those who would, like, work with their card in their shoe. You've heard this phrase before, you know, people who are former members who are not really good union members.
Yeah.
So anyway, the members of Local 150 have historically been very wise in their selection of their leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been very fortunate to have a series of president business managers who have been resourceful, smart, and fearless. And so when Bill Dugan, my first boss, was elected in 1986, he did a number of things that were very important to set the stage for the progress and growth of Local 150, less than 10,000 members at that time. We're at over 24,000 today.
Yeah.
One of the first things he did was he convinced the members to establish what are called administrative dues or working dues. You know, your due structure historically was a base dues that you would just had to pay in order to keep your card. Administrative or working dues are dues that are a paycheck deduction, and they come out of your paychecks. You're only paying them when you're working.
Yeah.
But it's a percentage of what your salary is, your wages are. Now, at first, the Local 150 just did like 10 cents an hour, and then they finally realized we got to change that because we don't want to keep asking for more money.
Yeah, percentage, if it's percentage-based.
Right, if it's a percentage basis, then you can index it. So with that money, then one of the other things that Mr. Dugan did was to hire our first organizer, which was our current president business manager, Jim Sweeney.
Uh-huh.
Jim was of the mind, and along with Bill's leadership, that being aggressive, filing election petitions with the labor board, doesn't really get you what you want. What you're looking for is a contract.
Yeah, you don't want to get stuck in court fighting over, you know, who's eligible to vote for 6 months. You want to actually just get the thing resolved.
Legal limbo,
So the strongest tool in the toolbox is the strike or other kinds of efforts to apply economic pressure on offending contractors or employers.
Mm-hmm.
So one way that they decided over time, learned that publicizing our struggles was critical to getting popular support for our strike or whatever we're trying to accomplish. At first, we're talking Sweeney, Dugan, a couple of the other early organizers, went out and purchased from costume makers rat suits.
Right.
You know, the idea was, okay, you know, people are sort of oblivious to strikers these days? Oh, picket signs, oh, guys
they
are
don't care, they, right?
Yeah, you know, sometimes they honk, and a lot of times they're just listening to the radio or on their phone now, whatever.
Yeah.
But back in the day, you know, you put a couple of guys on a picket line in a rat suit, it started to attract attention.
Yeah, people are going to look. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all you want if you're on strike is you want people to come over and say, what's going on?
Right.
Right. That's right.
What are you guys doing out here?
Right.
Then you can hand them a handbill.
Right. Exactly. Or read the picket sign. We're on strike for better wages. We're on strike to protest on fair labor practices, et cetera. So as the rat suit began to reveal some downsides.
Stinkiness.
Well, in the summertime, they're very hot.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not really laundering them as often as you're, you know, washing your underwear. So, I mean, they would tend to get a little worn, a little stinky.
A little musty.
And, you know, sometimes the profile wasn't as big as you would hope for. So we had a organizer, business agent named Jim Sullivan, who's passed away. But
dear friend,
very dear friend, very effective guy, you know, wonderful person, and his wife also a very wonderful person who had a lot of connections to the theatrical industry.
Mm-hmm.
So she had connected with some costume makers and says, okay. I mean, that was actually one of the origin story for the rat suit.
Yeah.
But then we went back to her and said, we got to have something with a higher profile. So the very first inflatable rat was only like a little six-footer guy, but then we would affix him to the roof of a rat car. And then we painted the car up, you know, orange and black with the big scary-looking rat on the painted on the
and
car.
The words rat patrol. Yep.
Rat patrol, that whole
and,
stuff.
And this is all protected speech, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because obviously the businesses don't want to see a giant rat in front of their business, in front of their property, but...
And that is the beauty of it, because in addition to attracting attention and public support, the contractors hate the rat.
Yes.
Sweeney has said this over and over again. They hate it. They don't want to be that person who's the target of the rat.
As opposed to like our members or the general public, I've seen it so many times where people will come over to the rat and they'll get together, they'll take a selfie with Scabby. We have members who do their Christmas card family photos at our picnic with a bunch of rats. So people love the rat.
They do.
Unless it's on your lawn.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And with the inflatable rat, the first rat you're talking about, we're talking back in like 1988 here, and this is the first time it's ever been done.
That's
Nobody
right.
ever thought of this before.
Nobody ever did, and those who copied us and claimed ownership are wrong. We have, and we have the proof. It was 88, 89 that we first started to use the rat on the car, and then when we started to get bigger rats, because if the point is to like have a higher profile, then the rat starts to get bigger, and it's awkward to put him on the top of the car, so you just sort of set him up.
Yeah.
And he starts out at 8 feet, then he got to be 10 feet, then he got to be 14 feet. But anyway, when we began to use the rats more often, we had a contest. Local 150 ran a picture of the rat in the December edition of the 1989 newspaper, the 150 Engineer, and it says, win a t-shirt or win a jacket, name the rat. And at least three members said Scabby. You should call him Scabby. And so those three members got jackets. But then we published the picture of Scabby the rat and the members in the January 1990 paper.
Yeah.
So when other trades, who shall remain nameless, bricklayers, come back and say they invented it, they couldn't put a date on it. And the one article that actually made the papers, the business manager, whoever it was who claimed ownership, was putting it around 1992 or 3.
Yeah.
So we had document proof.
Yeah.
And we made sure everybody knew this is the original.
This is the historical record. Yeah. Now, did the early versions have the festering wound on the belly of modern day Scabby, or was it just
it was like a solid color?
Okay.
Later producers of the rat, I think, you know, got a little bit more extravagant,
graphic,
and creative, and you know, brought out the real gore of what a rat is.
Well, and you wanted him to be scary.
Okay.
So he got scary.
Yeah.
As time went on.
Yeah. Beady eyes and sharp teeth. Yeah.
And as he spreads across the country, different people add their own little spin to it, right?
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories about the people hate him, but one of the very few responses that had any kind of thought or cleverness was in New York when the New York Building Trades put up a rat outside of like the Right to Work Foundation's offices, and they came back with an even bigger inflatable cat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a little clever. I'll give them credit.
That is really good.
Cat and mouse play. So the rat has been an effective tool, an effective symbol for years, and it continued on from here and was integral in strikes. It spread around throughout the operating engineers, through the international trades all over the Midwest, all over the country, all over the world. And then in, I think it was year 2000, Scabby got in trouble in Orland Park, I think is where that happened, right, Dale?
Yes, Orland Park, Illinois, yes. And the legal history of Scabby goes back, again, into the 90s as we began to use it more often. We were getting unfair labor practice charges and things like that. The labor board first said, you know, this is not up to us to police your rat.
Yeah.
And so we got favorable treatment. But we landed in federal court in, like, 1997 or 8. When one of the western suburbs, Addison, tried to stop us using their sign ordinances. We took them to court, offered a First Amendment theory, and after about a half a day of testimony, the judge said, we're going to break for lunch, and the lawyers for the town came over and says, we give up. We don't want this.
It's not looking so good here, is it?
Was this in state court?
Yeah, no, it's in federal court.
Oh, federal, okay.
Because we're advancing a First Amendment theory.
Got
that,
it.
You know, it's free speech. So once we got that, we got dismissal orders, and one of the things that we did was we wanted to make it clear that we were entitled to a fee award, and so they agreed to the fee award. And then thereafter, when anybody would threaten us, we would say, hey, we got a federal court decision that says we can do this, and oh, by the way, you're going to pay our fees,
pay our fees
if
yeah.
you make us go to court again. Well, flash forward to 2000, now we've got Scabby the Rat outside of the Crystal Tree Golf Course in Orland Park, and we had the rat on the right-of-way, I forget the street, 147th, maybe something like that. And then we also had it at the Forest Preserve. So, again, they invoked their sign ordinances to try to stop us. Now, at that time, the chief of police of Orland Park was his name McCarthy, the guy who took
the
bullet? The guy
who took the bullet for Reagan.
Right, correct.
Oh.
He had retired from the Secret Service, I guess, was high heels from his wounds, was originally an Illinoisan, got this job as the Orland Park police chief. So when they say, you got to move the rat, and we say no, they seize the rat.
Arrested the rat.
They arrested Scabby
the rat. Brought him to the police station.
That's right. And so how are we going to respond? Well, we put the word out, and on a Saturday morning, we had about 200 Local 150 members go visit the Orland Park police station, and we put up two more inflatable rats in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. Well, it's this chief, McCarthy, comes out. Bill Dugan is there. Who's in charge here? He says. Bill Dugan says, I'm in charge. Get your rat out of here. Get these people out of here. I'm going to arrest you all. He's like, you arrest us, you're going to have 2,000 members
right.
here in about 2 hours, and you're going to have 10 rats. And McCarthy, like, turns on his heel, and he walks away, kind of stops away, and he gets about 10 feet away, and he turns around again. He comes back to Dugan, and he says, if I give you your rat back, will you all just leave? He
sure.
says, yeah, that's all we want. We
right.
want our rat back.
The what guys, else are you doing there?
The members are on there. They're chanting, free Scabby, free
that's
Scabby,
great.
Free Scabby.
Well, so, also, you had a legal right to be there, right? I mean, it's public
it's on
property.
Public property.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
yeah.
right. Absolutely. And,
yeah.
and again, it's a public forum in First yeah. Amendment parlance. So, you know, we've got free speech rights.
Yeah.
So we the Dugan then turns. Enters the police station with Chief McCarthy, and of course, once he gets inside, the crowd starts to chant, free Dugan, free Dugan, free Dugan, and then
that's
when
right.
he comes back out with the rat, he's the hero. Well, the court case was not over. We
right.
we did sue Orland Park because we wanted to make it clear that we had this right, and it was Judge Castillo at the time who starts out his opinion. You know, some might say that a 14-foot, you know, inflatable rat is, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But we find that it is symbolic speech protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution.
And that's the important
Love
piece,
it.
That this inflatable rat is a protected tool of free speech.
Yeah.
And that was the first decision. Shout out to Judge Ruben Castillo. I don't know where you are, but we love you. We'll send you a free T-shirt.
There's been subsequent cases.
There have been many cases
yeah,
all over the country.
Recently, a couple years ago, right?
Yeah. Right. In districts all over the country, this has been tried. And then more recently, a couple years ago, the Trump NLRB general counsel went after rats.
That's
saying
right.
that they were illegal. We were using them illegally. And, you know, there were two cases against Local 150. There were cases against local unions kind of around the country, maybe a half dozen cases, maybe a few more.
Yeah. But the Carpenters are part of one of those, yeah.
I'm sure, yeah. That was one of the decisions was, it's so hard to get away from this free speech decision because that judge in 2000 said it's a clear tool, you know, clearly protected tool of free speech. That, you know, who can go against it? How can you make any argument against
right.
it?
Right, and then I'm glad you mentioned that the carpenters were involved in this because the carpenters' unions, especially on the West Coast, played a key role in the legal development of these concepts when they started to use banners. The problem is picketing is regulated And if you engage in what's called secondary picketing, right, it's unlawful. You can get enjoined by a federal court and or subject to a damage suit in, you know, in federal court from anybody who's injured by your conduct. The Carpenters were able to press the point and succeed in demonstrating that a stationary banner was not picketing. So you made a distinction between something that's more like pure speech and something which is the speech plus a picket sign and a picket line.
That's why they have all the disclaimer language saying
that's
this.
Right. The sign means we're on strike if the sign says on strike. If the sign says something else...
If you don't use a sign at all, you put it on a banner, shame on so-and-so and a rat. So now that's what...
But then you say that this claim is against such-and-such contractor, not the business that you have the banner out in front of.
Right. So of course, they hate him. And if you're a third party, they hate it even more. Right. Whoa, why are you out here in front of my place?
Exactly.
Because you're using him.
Yeah.
Hence the effectiveness of the rat.
Indeed. Yes. So the melding of the rat and the banner then is how it has evolved. And that's what the general counsel to the labor board went after, and there was about a half a dozen cases, and some of them were Carpenters and another one in New York, and then there was us too, but we were able to prevail based on the First Amendment theory. We actually convinced the Republicans on the labor board under the Trump Republicans agreed with the decision that the rat was protected speech.
Maybe the First Amendment.
Fascinating. Right. And obviously it's effective, none of the people in the labor world and building trades would use it. You know, obviously effective.
The inflatable rat, I mean, it was on The Sopranos. I know that Jim Sweeney's wife, he's got a story where they're sitting home watching The Sopranos and there appears Scabby, and she was the one who drew the first sketches, on a picket sign way back when. So, you know, I was like, there's your rat, sweetheart. Made it pretty big. He was on Billions. It's been used all over the world. Australia had a big use of it a few years ago. And it's because it works. It works. People like it. It draws attention. It attracts attention to the cause of workers who are trying to, you know, get their gripes out into the public and have the public understand good companies and bad companies. And I think that's why certain times the government will attempt to go after it, because it is powerful.
Oh, yeah. Especially in a big city. I mean, when you have all that foot traffic walking by and they see that rat, that business owner is like, all right, what do I got to do?
So
I got to kick out?
We have to take a break in a minute. But folks, if you see an inflatable rat on a job site and you're driving around town, just know that it started here in Chicago. It's all over the world, but it started here in Chicago. That rat's name is Scabby. And honk your horn or go over and say hello to the workers, because they're out there trying to do something. So go over and talk to them. Find out what's going on. Maybe give them a little bit of your support.
Yeah. Ultimately, it's about raising wages for working families.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, Dale, thank you, as always, for coming in with the history of Scabby.
For enlightening us.
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, stay with us, everybody, and we'll be back with more Workers' Mic right here on 720 WGN.
You're listening to The Workers' Mic, powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial.
Welcome back to The Workers' Mic on 720 WGN. I'm Phil Davidson here with Ed Maher and Dale Pearson. That was a fascinating segment, Dale. Before we wrap up the show, Ed, you were on with John Hansen this week on Your Money Matters talking about a big topic in the news right now, and that was the blocked sale of U.S. Steel to Nippon.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit more about that and the implications and what happened.
Japanese steelmaker Nippon was trying to buy U.S. Steel.
Yep.
U.S. Steel used to be an enormous juggernaut of a company, first billion-dollar company in the world, and now is no longer the largest steelmaker even in the United States. So the Biden had overseen the review of this purchase by a federal agency that basically evaluates things like this for national security.
And is that CFIUS?
Sure.
Yeah.
CFIUS.
Yes, right.
CFIUS says no.
Foreign investment security,
So 18 months in, they say, we've determined that this would be it would be bad for national security to allow this purchase to go through, so President Biden blocked it. And, part of the reason for that, I guess, is that this would be a foreign entity not investing in new steel production or expansion of domestic steel production, but taking control over existing production, you know, where the United States needs its steel that we produce domestically for countless things. And to have, a foreign entity take control of that would be a problem. And so U.S. Steel and Nippon were quickly into court suing the Biden administration and suing the steelworkers, maybe, I think, too, for they said it was collusion. The steelworkers have been against this. And they're they didn't get a really warm response from President Trump either, because he essentially just said this was a panel of experts that determined that this would be bad for national security. So we don't, we're not going to push back against that.
It sort of ties into his position on tariffs as well, about keeping manufacturing here domestically. So I get why he might not be the best ally in the situation.
You know, on the steelworker point, the allegation that the U.S. Steel spokesperson made was that steelworkers traded an endorsement of Biden for this decision. And that's why they're a defendant now.
Got it.
Interesting. Well, the steelworkers were against this from the start. And when you get into it, because, you know, as this came about and it's been coming about over the past couple of weeks, I read a lot about this. And the thing that sort of jumped out to me that I found really interesting was this notion that came from the steelworkers that, you know, in Pennsylvania and Indiana, you have a large unionized workforce of, you know, old school blast furnace steel mill workers. Mm-hmm. And then there are some new, you know, smaller furnaces down in, electric furnaces down in like Texas, where they just recycle scrap and things like that. So the feeling was that if Nippon bought this, they would be shutting down those legacy facilities, let's call them, in Pennsylvania and Indiana, and moving everything to something smaller in Texas, winding down the operation, making it a smaller company, and reducing...
crushing those communities.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And reducing their ability to compete in a global marketplace. So why would this have been worth $14 billion to Nippon? Because they could take away a competitor.
Yeah.
And so when you think about it like that, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And now I know U.S. Steel has other companies courting it, some domestic company like Cleveland-Cliffs, and I think maybe one other. But whatever is going to happen, I think that the steel workers and, you know, they're going to keep fighting to make sure that whoever buys it protects those jobs and invests in those older facilities to kind of bring them up and keep them functioning well into the future. Because it's U.S. Steel. It was the biggest company in America for a long, long time. And, you know, it's a namesake. And interestingly enough, U.S. Steel, they love their attorneys. We all love attorneys. They love their attorneys enough that they named a town in Indiana after their attorney. Their attorney's name was Gary. And that's the name of Gary, Indiana.
Get out of here.
I'm not kidding. Look it up. But we are out of time. But thank you for being with us. Thank you, Dale, for coming in. Always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Phil. This was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks. That was awesome.
And Jim Sweeney, what'd you think about it?
I do want to say this is a great forum, and we are getting the word out. I hear more and more good things about this.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
You're too kind, Jim.
Kind
You're
of
too
you to
kind.
Say. Happy almost birthday to you too, sir. We'll be back with you next week with more Workers' Mike right here on 720 WGN.
The preceding episode of The Workers' Mike was powered by the National Coalition of Labor and sponsored by Megan Financial, Premise Health, and Voya Financial. For additional information and podcasts of The Workers' Mike, visit WGNradio.com.